welcome to episode 154 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other unreliable narrators as masterpieces. I am Nick, and I am joined, as ever, by my unreliable contributor, Roger.
Or am I?
We'll never know. And that's the whole story of the effing film. Anyway, we're returning to Akira Kurosawa, whose work we previously, I think it's fair to say, greatly enjoyed with Seven Samurai.
Yeah, we're four years earlier than that, I believe.
But we are...
It's that same setting, the historical Japanese... Yeah, the year is not well-defined.
Medieval Japan... Well, medieval doesn't really apply well to Japan,
It is the age of samurai going about doing pretty much what they like unless somebody is better at fighting than them.
Lawlessness and bandits.
We can actually pin down the date slightly, but I'll come back to that later.
Okay.
I think
we're in Kyoto or somewhere near it.
The thing that is notable for me is it's very unglamorous. I mean, it's obviously nice to be a samurai, but as we will see here, and as we see in The Seven Samurai, that is no guarantee of having a good life.
By itself, yes. In fact, in some ways, I guess, we should mention we're talking about Rashomon from 1950.
Or are we?
I'm going to start with a slight quote from a small quote from one of our inspirations, David Thompson, who wrote Have You Seen, where he talks about 1,000 or so films. And here he talks about Rashomon, and this certainly applies to me. Even if you haven't seen Rashomon, you'll likely have heard of it. You vaguely know the way in which Rashomon-like applies to a story in which you get several points of view that amount to a total contradiction and a revelation of the lies we tell. That certainly summed up what I knew about the film before I came to it.
I'll come back to this later when we've talked about it in a bit more detail, but I don't think that's entirely fair. I think there is something we get here which is not really touched on much in The Imitators, but we'll come back to that.
I think I might, we'll work our way through, but I might have an inkling of where you're going. But we're back in miserable time. I guess what it means to be a samurai is you might have a slightly less shitty time than a peasant. And at least if you're having a bad day, you can kill a peasant and no one can complain about it. But that's about the sum total of the good things about being a samurai. In this story, we have a very small cast.
Well, this is actually two separate stories, which may account for some of the separation that's going on here. Rashomon itself, these are both stories by Urinosuke Akutagawa, who was writing in the 1910s, 1920s. Rashomon itself is basically a story of these guys end up at the ruined gate of Kyoto.
Yes. The thing everyone knows about Rashomon isn't actually in that story, it's in the other story.
Yeah, and the other story is in a grove, which in the original version has seven separate testimonies.
Oh, thank goodness they dropped it to four.
Yeah, it's actually a reasonably accurate version of In a Grove.
Okay.
It compresses the accounts, obviously, but... essentially, the contrasting viewpoints are there, whereas it's not the only real... Rashomon, the frame story, is much less faithful. That's fair enough.
Well, the framing story is really three strangers gather at a gate. I think it's a gate of some kind.
Well, yeah, that's an odd thing in itself. It looked to me initially like some kind of ruined temple or something of that sort.
Yeah.
I suspect this is a thing that if you know your Japanese history, you just instantly recognize.
Yes.
Kyoto was extensively damaged in the Onin War of Western dating, 1467, 1477. And, samurai factions were fighting, court nobility factions were fighting, religious factions were fighting, noble mansions turned into fortresses. You know, they casually dug deep trenches across the streets for defensive works. Lots of buildings got destroyed, many of them by fire. So we're basically in that period of about 100 years when Kyoto was maybe not comprehensively ruined, but it was not a place you went to start your exciting new business.
Well, this is so framing that as a, you know, an age of chaos, murder.
But also, you know, casually, this gate is clearly quite damaged. It's not going to stop anybody getting past it, and they casually pull down bits of wooden decoration to start a fire.
Yeah, it's got a slightly almost post-apocalyptic feel in that sense. And that's one of my problems with the framing device, in the sense that, and the characters comment on it, this is an age where everyone's getting killed all the time for no reason, and yet we focus in on this one murder, possible rape in a forest, to the point where they are taken to the police and questioned by a judge.
Well, yeah, he was an important guy who died.
Well, yes, I guess it is a samurai that dies, I suppose. But it felt a little... it stretched my credulity a bit. The characters do comment on that and say, basically, well, everyone's dying all the time. Why do we care about this one? But still, it didn't quite work for me. Mm. So we have them discussing the aftermath of this case. We don't actually find out what happens in the end as far as the judgment goes or anything like that, as I recall.
But basically we've got, what is it, woodcutter and priest are already there and peasant arrives.
Yes.
They don't actually have names in this frame story. And priest is despairing at the state of the world and, you know, everybody is horrible. How can I be a priest anymore?
Mm.
Woodcutter is perhaps a bit more pragmatic, but also scared because... See previous comments, any summer I can cut him down without even having to fill in any paperwork.
Whereas our peasant is kind of resigned to the situation that he is disposable, red shirt of the film, and is quite sort of relaxed about it, and is basically a realist compared to the other two. So we do have these three contrasting worldviews, and they get to talking, as you do, on a post-apocalyptic night in Kyoto. And we discover the source of their distress, which is a murder has been done in the forest around Kyoto. And then we get... this is where the film started to lose me, because we get a long sequence of the woodcutter walking through a forest. Now, it's beautifully lit. It may be... again, it's revolutionary for its time, I guess... Because it's natural lighting, or as close to natural lighting as they could get. We get the dappled lighting coming through the leaves. It's beautiful. Goes on a bit, though, doesn't it?
Yes, I wrote down, and now we will sing the Walking Through the Woods song. there are two technical points I noticed that I think would have been surprising to audiences at the time. One is that the camera is allowed to point at the sun, which you just did not do.
Certainly not when you're on the moon.
Although this wouldn't have been unusual in 50s film, I suspect it's quite unusual in 50s Japanese film. The camera moves quite a lot.
Well, we were talking about tracking shot. I remember the Most Dangerous Game, where we get one of the first ever tracking shot, and that was in the 30s. But yeah, here it's very... the camera is almost a character in here. Which is good, because the characters aren't much of characters. But we do get to move along with the action, and it also, it's quite important because it gives us, it's showing us perspective. We're not here from a kind of God's eye third person viewpoint. We are, and we're in the perspective of whoever is narrating the scene. Not directly,
but at least we're down there with them.
That's what I mean. We're not looking out of their eyes, but we're in their sort of world, and we look at the world. The camera moves in the way they see the world, so it's quite a close third person perspective, I guess.
It's also a thing we've sometimes said before, that if in a film or in reality somebody says this happened, then you have that way of evaluating, okay, is he looking shifty? Does he look as if he's trying to make things up? Is he shading it to make himself look good, and so on. Which, when it is all filmed, probably by the same person, is a thing that is not quite available.
Well, it's a bit, and again, I'm sure we've talked about this before in other films with unreliable narrators, that the whole film is sort of playing on the fact that if you see a thing being, you see a thing happening, you assume that's what happened, but the whole point of the film really is, well, no, it's just as unreliable as someone telling you the story. And you don't really get that in a book because, as you say, you get a lot of clues in a book. When there's a flashback, you are clearly seeing it from someone's perspective. It's not generally told from a god's eye perspective, a flashback. In a book, it's usually told as a narrative. But in a film, a flashback up until this point, as far as I'm aware, had been, well, this is what happened. Now you're segueing away to the actual thing that actually happened.
And this first one is the woodcutter saying, basically, I was out in the woods and I found a body.
Yeah. It takes 20 minutes to say that. I mean, this is not a long film.
I found some other stuff as well, but also there was a body. And at that point, I panicked and ran away.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is perfectly reasonable. There is no reason at this point to doubt his story.
I mean,
I think it's fair to say it's accurate as far as it goes. It just misses some stuff out, as we will see later.
It elides a fair chunk, yes, exactly. Now, we have... this is a returning actor, a Ribbon of Memes alumnus. This is Takashi Chimura, who we previously saw in Seven Samurai as the old wise samurai, as I recall, the veteran, the good one. But then it's inescapable to notice the next character who appears in our story, because then they discuss the testimony of the bandit.
So basically Woodcutter saw this, ran away back to the nearest magistrate or equivalent, said, help, help, I found a body, and there has been a criminal investigation. There is also his status is unclear. I think he's effectively a sort of junior police official. I believe in the culture, he's actually effectively a trusty prisoner who's been given this job, saying, I just captured this famous bandit, Takemura.
Yes.
And, obviously he did it. Sorry, Tajumaru.
Tajumaru, who is played by Toshiro Mifune?
Guy I love to see. He was also in Seven Samurai. And
so he's the very memorable samurai in Seven. He's the crazy,
isn't really a samurai.
Yes.
And again here, he's something of an outsider. I think the impression I get is that the role he was typecast in as much as anything else is he's not classy, but he knows what's in the real world.
Yeah, down-to-earth, realistic. I found it a bit wearing, actually, because his character is so similar to his Seven Samurai character.
And has this tendency suddenly to burst into laughter when he thinks he said something funny.
Yeah, and it's it may be a cultural thing, but it worked for me in Seven Samurai, actually. Maybe because he contrasts so much with all the... But this time I'd seen that before, even though Seven Samurai came later. And I felt it is real, a real style of kind of, it's very physical acting that he does, but it's sort of stage exaggerated acting. Do you know what I mean? It's very kind of placed and, I don't know. It had shades to me a little bit of Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys of, I'm crazy and these are my crazy acting. And I prefer, I think, a slightly more understated way. But I have to admit, if you're going to hire Toshiro Mifune to act in your film, you probably don't want the understated version of him. And certainly Kurosawa didn't.
So, he basically says, I saw this guy coming along the road and he had his wife with him. And oh boy, she was gorgeous. So obviously I followed him and then lured him away, attacked him, went back, raped her, etc. I'm not going to go into the details of how exactly each story happened, but that's the thing that I think is interesting here, because in the Imitators it's generally more blatantly different, but in this every version of this we get four narratives in the end, but they all agree that Tajumaru did rape the wife.
Yes, there's no question about that. There's even the more sympathetic views don't have her going along with it. There's no consent given, let's put it that way, I don't think.
Goodness, I am so very, very bored with this woman is so beautiful that men just can't help themselves.
Wasn't
as well worn here, but even so.
It happens because she's veiled And she's obviously veiled for a reason, because a man who sees her, and as he does, he catches a glimpse of her under the forest light with the dappled light. As soon as he sees her, yeah, he knows he's got to rape her and kill him, which he does in his story. So, yeah, I agree. That is a pretty tired cliche.
And the bit that starts this of he follows, he leads the samurai off basically saying, I found an old cache of weapons, which is obviously highly valuable, and I will let you have them cheap. Lures him away, jumps the guy, leaves him tied up, goes back, takes the woman, then
he
leads her
to,
back to where the samurai has been captured.
So he can rape her in front of him. It's not quite explicitly stated like that, but I think
the
plan.
There's only one thing I know about the censorship rules under which this film was made, though I would obviously assume quite heavy censorship given the whole US occupation forces and so on. I do know that they had just released the rules enough that newspapers were allowed to report rapes by occupying troops that year.
In 1950.
Yeah. So.
Blimey. Okay, so it's slightly, I mean, it is, to me, it's not that subtle, but it's slightly danced around and not especially dwelled upon, and it's dealt in a kind of a queasy way. But the point is that in this story, the main way that the stories all differ is who killed the samurai, actually. Most of the rest of the story is close.
Yeah, basically, what the samurai did, what the wife did, what Tajibaro did in various combinations and orders.
Yes. Well, in this one, the samurai and him have a noble fight, and he finally defeats him.
And so then we get the testimony of the wife.
Yes. And this is, this is, I'll try. Machiko Kyo. Okay, who is... there seems to be I don't know if that's a historical thing or a Japanese thing at the time, but it was basically of either powdering out or shaving off your eyebrows and then drawing them back as kind of blurry patches in the middle of your forehead, which I found extremely distracting. Again, a cultural thing, but I was so distracted by that for a lot of it, I found the story slightly hard to follow in places. Her story
I just kept reminding myself, this is one of Japan's first sex symbols.
Right. Yeah.
To my modern taste, but that's my problem, not hers.
Well, I mean, she's a very handsome lady, but not to the point where if you saw her, you would... I don't know if I've ever seen anyone that was to the point of you would need to do that.
Oh, well, yeah, you're a grown-up. But...
true.
All evidence to the contrary.
To be fair, Tajimaru is supposed to be basically a man-child, I think, for the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's saying you ought to grow up, because you know, he's a bandit, that's just the guy he is. But yes, I agree, that's the way he's presented.
And so we get another version of events, which is vaguely different. She gets raped, and then she... How does her story go? No, I've forgotten what she says happens. She says that she killed... In each of the perspectives, they say that they kill the husband, because he is so disgusted with her being raped in front of her that he no longer wants anything to do with her and casts her away. So she stabs him with a dagger.
Mm-hmm.
That's her story. And then we have the third story.
There is a struggle and she faints, and when she wakes up, there is a dagger in his chest.
Yes, but holding the dagger when she went.
She's assuming that, but yeah, even she doesn't actually know, assuming she's telling the truth.
Oh, deep. And then we have the slightly unexpected testimony of the corpse. Via a medium, who then tells his own. I kind of like this, that the priest, this further shatters the belief. In fact, this is seems to be what has shattered the priest's view of the world, is that he can't accept the possibility that someone who's dead might lie. Because what does that even mean? It's just horrifying to him. But we have another perspective.
Nobody even suggests that the medium might be a fraud, I should point out.
No, exactly. He just takes it as granted that this is the words of the dead man.
And there's another quite nice technical touch here, which is it's obviously the voice of Takehiro Kanazawa, to which the medium is lip syncing.
Yes, which is, that does
you
work.
Know, it's not a big thing, but it's a nice touch given the technology of the day. There's not a whole lot else you could do, but it works rather nicely.
It does. Well, it looks unusual and slightly unearthly. It just. Yeah, it shouldn't work as well as it did. But
the role of a Miko is a even by the standard Japanese culture, it's a bit strange. It's sort of shamany and it's sort of socially and yeah.
Well, in my translation, it said medium, but I suspect it's not as simple as that to come across.
I mean, in this film, that is effectively what she is, but she is a medium that everybody trusts rather than one who's saying, oh, yeah, you know, give me five strings of cash and I'll tell the answers.
Okay, so it's an equivalent of a some kind of priest or wise woman, a trusted communer with the dead, anyway. So then we get either the shyster medium's story or the husband's story.
I don't think we have any reason to assume that it's not the husband's recounting.
I think from the film, we're given the idea. But again, the whole point of the film is you can't trust these things. Yeah. But I think in the context of that, it does seem to be the perspective of the samurai, who then claims that he killed himself.
but first of all, you know, post-rape, the wife, Tajamaru proposes to the wife because, gosh, you're so wonderful. I must have you come away with me and live like a bandit in the woods. And in this version, she says, yeah, okay, but you got to knock off my husband first.
Yes. And he is so disgusted at the dishonor of the woman that he's just raped that he then storms off.
Bros before samurai ladies, right?
Exactly. I mean, no, I don't think the film is in any way saying any of these people are good or...
I think it is saying that the socialization between men is much, even enemies, is much stronger than the socialization between women.
Yes. I don't think it's passing a judgment on whether it thinks that's a good thing or not, but it's certainly, when the characters act in that way, it's believable given the society that they're in. Anyway, he storms off.
She runs away. Tajamaru runs away. Tajamaru comes back and lets unties the samurai, who then kills himself.
Yes.
Honorably.
Yes, honorably.
And at some point later, somebody removes the dagger from his chest, but he doesn't know who.
The valuable dagger.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, yeah, he's still sort of alive at that point, or his spirit's still in his body or whatever. Anyway, I'm going to admit, I was not enjoying the film at this point, and I was feeling bad because I wasn't enjoying the film, because I'm supposed to enjoy the film because it's Kurosawa, who I already know I like.
Everybody says it's a classic.
Everyone says it's one of his best and it's great. You know, we are half-assed film critics or whatever we are, and I feel like we should like...
Between us, we manage a full-ass.
Yeah, okay. Full-assed film critics. It's a very... Now, I don't... Well, I'm allowed to. I'm a viewer. I can complain about the pacing if I like. It is really slow pacing, this film. Really slow.
Not helped, of course, by most of... I mean, all these conflicting accounts are taking place in the same glade with the same people.
Yes. There is not a ton of variety. We've basically got two locations. Three, I suppose, if you count the sandy kind of interrogation plane that they're on, but we've got the ruined temple or gate or whatever it is, and we've got the forest, and we never really go anywhere else. And we spend most of our time in the forest looking at the same people say very similar things and do very similar things that are slightly different. And I was, to be honest, I didn't really like... So we've got three main characters, honestly, in this drama. We've got the wife, the bandit, and the samurai. I didn't like any of them, and so I didn't really care what happened, ultimately.
Well, that's a good thing, because you don't find out.
I'm supposed to be maddened at curiosity about what actually happened.
Interested. Yeah, so that is the end of the courthouse flashbacks.
Yes.
And we don't find out what happened, though. I mean, I think we would just assume that Tajamaru is going to get put to death.
Yeah, he assumes it anyway.
all of the narratives agree that he raped the woman, even if he doesn't agree that he killed the samurai. And I suspect that alone would be enough to get him put to death. Not to mention Notorious Bandit and all the rest.
Yeah, but it's not looking good for Tojimaru, and he knows it.
And so now we're back to the gate, and we're back to the woodcutter, who now admits, well, no, that it wasn't like that at all.
I happen to actually stay and see the whole thing from a bush.
I saw him killed by a sword, and the commoner, I don't know whether this is supposed to be a salt of the earth thing, but he basically gets the guy to admit that yes, he saw it, and then he lied to avoid getting into trouble. And this version, Tajimura begs the wife to marry him. She frees her husband, who tosses her away because she's soiled, obviously.
Yes. No one comes out this well in pretty much any version of the story.
Yeah, there's this whole telegony thing that is only believed in the modern day by certain American dog breeders in the Russian Orthodox Church. Once a woman has, or female animal of any sort, has been with the non-authorized male, some influence of that sort will stay with them forever in their future offspring. And
they are tainted.
This doesn't happen, folks, but anyway.
It's not an uncommon viewpoint, even in less extreme circles, unfortunately, but...
In this version, Tajimaru begs the wife to marry him. She frees the husband. He tosses her away. She's expecting him to kill Tajimaru.
Yes.
And he doesn't think it's worth it. Tajimaru says, oh, well, in that case, I don't want to marry you after all. And she basically goads them into fighting each other, which they really don't want to do.
No, and then they have this much more comedic slapstick fight. It's not clear that's just whether this is how Farmer thinks all fights go, or whether it's a more realistic version. I think there is a slight, for all its, ooh, you'll never know what happened, there is a slight suggestion by the film. Now, that may be just my training of when you watch this sort of unreliable narrator, then the actual truth will be revealed at the end, because that's how a lot of films do it. That isn't explicit here.
Yeah,
but it does...
there is no giant diegetic reason to assume that the woodcutter is being any more reliable than anybody else, except that he has now changed his story and he's saying something different from what he said earlier.
Yeah, maybe that's it. So it might be my post-Rashomon training in watching flashback films, and it might be, yes, that he's got a more plausible reason to tell the truth, but it feels like his story is maybe more true than the others. But it's not. I mean, the film does never says you could quite justifiably read it as any of the stories, or I think more accurately that none of them are quite true. And I think that's the whole point of the film.
But at this point, Tajimaru wins the fight. The wife runs away. Tajimaru steals the sword because, hey, free sword. But forgets to steal the dagger, even though it's a valuable dagger. Which is the thing he said earlier in his own testimony.
Yes. So we know it's I guess in this one, sort of, the peasant, the farmer kills the samurai, but it's not really.
Dagger at the end of it. Tajimaru does actually kill the samurai, and the woodcutter
he gives him the fatal blow,
steals the dagger,
pulls the knife out of it. Yes, yeah, fair enough.
That's the end of that story, in fact.
Yeah, we never get any more information about what happens, and we never know for sure what happened. And yeah, I think talking it through now, that's the failure to me, is that I couldn't give a shit what actually happened. I'm so bored of these people in this forest fighting each other. In some versions of the tale, the wife's awful. In some versions, the samurai's awful. In pretty much all versions, Tojimaru's awful. And I don't care what happened to any of them. And that is maybe a failure of the film. It does end on...
And I
on
wrote
an optimistic
down,
note.
He tells his story and then they mope around until they're energized by the power of baby.
Yes, a baby is randomly there. Randomly has not made any noise at all during the proceeding. This is only an hour and a half film. This is a Ribbon of Memes Plus, but it's one of those hour and a half films that felt longer to me. But the baby suddenly starts crying. The peasant goes and nicks baby robes, wrappings, cloth, whatever. The priest and the farmer are both horrified by this. They chase the peasant off, who goes off to be awful somewhere else. but it turns out, it transpires that the farmer, through this, the woodcutter sold the dagger to feed his six kids that he already has. And so he then condemns this child to a further life of poverty with his other six kids, which gives the priest hope for humanity because he agrees to take it on. And for all we know, that the baby is now going to be what feeds the other six kids that he's got. I mean, we know, no guarantee that he's going
to
go.
Got to fatten it up a bit first.
Exactly. Yeah, and then the film ends with sort of an optimistic thing, in that the rain stops and he goes out and it's.
Pathetic fallacy. Yeah, the priest has regained his faith, which is obviously a good thing. We know nothing about this priest apart from he's lost his faith, but now he's regained it, so that must be good.
That's definitely a good thing, obviously. I really, really wanted to like Rashomon. I didn't. I'm going to be honest. I unreliable narration is not news to me as a 2024 human being.
Mm.
And that's largely because of Rashomon, I guess. But I don't know. I feel the point it's making is a little trite. I mean, that is not a point you'd have to make in a book. It only works in cinema because if you see something, you believe it. And he's saying, well, actually, you know, that can be lies too. And yeah, I just
all
don't
right,
find
so
it.
So why did I watch it then?
Yeah, I don't know. At the end of Reservoir Dogs, I'm interested in what happened. I mean, they're all shits as well. But I care about who shot first and why did Mr. Pink escape. And I want to know the little... I'm interested in little stories behind it. Here, I really... I honestly do not care what happened to those three in that forest. And so spending an hour and a half having the same story retold with slight varieties of it... didn't work for me.
So I've been thinking of The Imitators, and I've certainly seen this done a lot in television. I mean, it's not quite the Most Dangerous Game level of ripoff, but it is a thing that a lot of series, long-running series have done, is some sort of, we will show the same events from multiple accounts.
Yes.
And eventually work out what happened. And well, that's one of the differences. One is they do eventually work out what happened.
Yes.
And the convention is usually that the last version shown, whether this is the account of the one honest witness or it's a reconstruction or something else, is the reality that you can take away and say, okay, that's what was really going on.
Well, this works better in, I guess, murder mysteries, which I'm not a huge reader or watcher of, but we did enjoy Knives Out and the other one that's set on the island that's got a peculiar name that I can't bring to mind at the minute.
Glass Onion.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it does a similar thing there with both of those.
Yeah, that's also true. But also, I think with those, there's a bit more point to it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what I'm trying to say. This feels like a trite point that isn't of that interest in and of itself.
I mean, in those other shows, generally the people who are giving the wrong accounts are not just trying to make themselves look good. They have a reason for giving that particular wrong account, like they are actually the murderer or they were up to something else and therefore they want to lie. In other words, it's the murder mystery convention of, yes, I'm going to tell you untruths, but there is a specific reason for these untruths as I'm telling you.
And I suppose...
It is the convention. I'm not saying it's more naturalistic, but to me it is more narratively satisfying that, you know, there was a reason for saying this.
That's a good way of putting it, because I think, in a way, I'm saying it's a trite point, but it is interesting. It's more interesting that, because in the murder mysteries that we're talking about, everyone has got a perfect memory, I guess. They bend it to whatever story they need to be. In Rashomon, as in real expert witnesses and witnesses in any kind of, anything where human memory has had to be relied upon, it is true that actually, we remember almost nothing, actually, of what's happened to us most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the memory often becomes stronger than, you know, repetition of a memory. I think we were talking about this offline, but repeating a false memory can actually create a false memory in yourself that feels realer than whatever it was you were talking about in the first place. So there is something very unusual about human memory that is certainly nothing like computer memory.
Memory is a lie. Consciousness is a lie. Sign up for my philosophy podcast.
It's called Nihilism 101.
You think you're conscious, eh?
I don't know. That would be for our philosophy podcast, but I don't know. Any philosophy that actually philosophizes yourself out of existence, I don't know. Maybe there's some problems. Let's go back to Rashomon. So I suppose, yes, that is an interesting point. Memory is unreliable. But, you know, even in the 20s, the 18s, this was a known thing, you know.
To be fair, there are still a lot of people who, even in law enforcement, who regard witness statements as essentially reliable, and most of them have now learned better, but not all of them even now.
True. But amongst academics and amongst experts, it was known that memory was not worth the neurons it was printed on, for the most part.
To be fair, I don't think that's what's going on in the context of the film. The reason for the differences of account, as I see it, are each of them is lying to make themselves look good. Like
consciously,
the honourable person,
do you think,
in this context.
Do you think consciously, or that's how they saw it?
Hard to say.
I
think the assumption would be consciously, because they, you know, there are inconsistencies of facts which could potentially be verified by another witness.
But they all incriminate themselves, for the most part, in the murder.
Mm.
Not in their best interest.
3 out of 4 versions of this, Tajimaru kills the samurai. 4 out of 4, he rapes the wife. And that's another thing that the imitators have generally not done. The imitator, if the story is a murder mystery story, which it often is, will say, well, that guy did the killing, or that guy did the killing, or this other guy did the killing. Matters of substantive fact that, again, going back to my earlier point, give you a reason to lie, because then it makes you look better, but it also makes you look not guilty.
See, I'm finding this conversation more interesting than Rashomon. I think it is an interesting subject. I don't know that it's got a lot to say about it from my perspective. Is that unfair? I don't know.
I'm going to have to say in the end, well, it probably is a masterpiece because of what it... And it is unfortunate that the two innovative things that it does, one, the multi-unreliable flashbacks, and two, the mobile camera outdoor shooting, are both things that to us just, you can do this on a film, so what?
I can see it was new and interesting and narratively, it was in an era where films told you a story and didn't cast doubt on things, so, we've had this before where I think we agree it's a masterpiece. I didn't enjoy it particularly, though, I have to say.
I cannot deny its influence, certainly. And
No.
The things that don't work for me now, and I suspect for you as well, are artifacts of all the... As we've talked before about The Lord of the Rings, my canonical example on this, the things it does have mostly been done better elsewhere.
Yes.
So when you go back and read the original, it doesn't strike one as amazing in itself, but it was the first one to do it. Except the linguistics. Nobody else has done the linguistics.
Well, they weren't a professor of linguistics. for the most part. Maybe some of them. Okay. Well, Rashomon, I feel like my overall feeling, it's perhaps more superficial than it thinks it is. It's not, as you say, we don't really get to know the characters very well. We don't really understand their motivations because they all have different motivations in different stories.
Most of them don't even have names. Some of them are named in the credits, but I think only Tajimaru is the person. I think he's the only guy whose name is spoken on screen.
Well, also, I think you're right.
I always find quite distancing.
Yeah, though, I mean, I think that's the same in Seven Samurai. And we didn't find that terribly distancing. Maybe if I hadn't seen, I think I'm going to call it a shtick, Toshiro Mifune's shtick. Maybe if I hadn't seen it before, I would have responded to it better. But I just found it a little irritating in this one. That's probably a cultural difference. But all I can say is I didn't find it irritating in Seven Samurai. I found it.
That's fair.
Do we have more to say about Rashomon?
We have to hand in our film critic cards because this is a classic that we didn't love.
I think that's, but we both agree it's a classic. That's a tricky one. But we can just tell everyone that we did love it.
recorded the podcast. You can only really enjoy it in the 16-hour extended cut. Unsubtitled, obviously.
I would still watch more Kurosawa. This will be my third, because I have seen Throne of Blood as well.
Yeah, that's on my list. Hidden Fortress, quite possibly, at some point.
Mm. I do like the era. I like the actors. Me dissing on Toshirô Mifune aside. But didn't... too slow-paced and... Yes, perhaps too old news for me to thoroughly enjoy.
I don't know what a specific best film for this would be, and if any audience member has an idea, please let me know. I would like to see Mifune in one of his hard bastard Yakuza roles.
Hmm. I'd like to see more of him, if only to see if he had a wider range than we have here.
Mm.
Well, there we are. It only remains for me to say, whatever you think you heard in this podcast, maybe you didn't.
I was with some friends down the pub all evening.